and welcome to this Lowy Institute live event to mark the launch of the 2020 edition of the Asia Power Index. A very warm welcome to everyone joining us from Australia and to those dialing in from overseas. My name is Hervé Lamier. I'm the director of the Power and Diplomacy Program here at the Lowy Institute in Sydney. Joining me today to discuss the pandemic and the balance of power are Senator the Honourable Penny Wong, Shadow Minister for Foreign Affairs and Leader of the Opposition in the Senate. We also have Professor Joseph Nye, Harvard University Distinguished Service Professor and former Dean of the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. And last but not least, we have Professor Yuen Fong Kong, Lee Ka-shing Professor of Political Science at the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy in Singapore. Thank you all for joining me. Before I go to our illustrious panelists, some quick housekeeping. At the bottom of your screens, you will see a Q&A button where you can submit questions to the panelists. We'll put as many of these questions as possible up to the panelists later in the discussion. Please include your name and your organization and any other affiliation. Let me begin though by introducing the 2020 edition of the Asia Power Index. And I really couldn't have done this without an entire research team that's worked on the project for many, many months. So I want to thank my co-pilot, Alyssa Leng. I want to thank Nicholas Bosworth and Bonnie Bly, who've both worked on the project previously, and in Bonnie's case, many years before. We're now into our third edition of this comprehensive mapping exercise of the changing distribution of power in Asia. The 2020 edition covers 3 years of data and is the most comprehensive one so far. We have 128 indicators, something like 30,000 data points, 26 countries. And what we can say about the findings is that this has really been a bit of a race to the bottom. So I might go directly to the slides now to show you how once we aggregate across all our data points, what we see is a bottom heavy constellation of power in Asia, still very much dominated by the United States and China. But the real trend over the course of this year has, of course, been the onset of COVID-19 and the way that has really triggered a race to the bottom, where countries have competed with each other only by degrees of underperformance. So 18 states in total registered sharp downward shifts in their relative power in 2020. It's a real reversal of fortunes to what we've seen before. Now, none has suffered a bigger downfall in relative standing in the region than the United States, which remains the most powerful country, but a 10-point overall lead over China 2 years ago has been narrowed by half in 2020. So far from being the undisputed unipolar power, I think it's probably more apt to describe the Indo-Pacific as well and truly bipolar, but we can discuss that later in the findings. Now, the coronavirus has contributed to a loss in US prestige in the region. America suffered the largest reputational hit in the region for both its domestic and its international handling of the COVID-19 pandemic. And I think this serves as a real reminder that legitimacy and leadership on the world stage begins with the capacity of leaders to govern well at home. Now, it's not just the COVID-19 pandemic that's played into the US's results, but also what we see is that the US has lost ground in areas where China is already ahead, notably in terms of its economic relationships, in terms of trade patterns in the region. But what we see in the investment side of things is also quite interesting, which is an increased bifurcation of investment patterns in the region. The US is still the largest net investor, outward investor in Asia, but it's concentrated in seven countries, in Australia, in India, in Japan, South Korea, New Zealand, and Singapore, as well as, of course, China, where the US remains the largest investor. Whereas China is doing more with less. It has less investment overall, but these are going into smaller economies like Cambodia, like Nepal, like Pakistan, where China has greater influence in the political economy of those countries. Now, it hasn't been a great year for China either, ranked second in the overall index. China has emerged diplomatically diminished, and its overall standing is unchanged. That in itself is interesting because it reveals both the stark strengths and weaknesses of China's ascendancy. So the US still paints an overall more rounded picture in terms of its performance across our eight measures of power, whereas China has pronounced strengths and pronounced weaknesses. The irony here is that China, despite being very effective, ruthlessly effective at suppressing the virus at home, has not registered any gains in its reputation abroad. That seems to be partly the development of a more belligerent attitude taken on the part of China's wolf warrior diplomats. But the other interesting findings for China are the fact that it's slightly up in terms of people exchanges, which is a driver of soft power. So we now have 58 million people in the rest of the region that travel annually to China. And this in itself is a contributor to China's increased presence and engagement with our region, as opposed to the United States. Where China has lagged a bit this year is in terms of the technological gap with the United States. That's an interesting phenomenon in itself, given the state of play in great power rivalry and the technological arms race that we're witnessing between these two superpowers. China is well ahead of the United States in terms of having the greatest share of the world's 500 most powerful supercomputers, but we've really seen a new injection of dynamism in US's technological innovation, particularly in terms of the space program and the public-private partnerships with the Silicon Valley giants. And one particular indicator I decided to choose out here was the number of satellites launched. Now, moving on, because it's not just the United States, the US and China that dictate the terms, but in fact, the Indo-Pacific ecosystem is created and sustained by many other actors. But let me focus for a minute on Japan here, which ranks third overall. Now, Japan is has reached near level parity in diplomatic influence with Beijing, which in itself is quite telling because China has the largest network of embassies globally and in the region, but Japan is ranked ahead for its capacity to exercise political leadership on the world stage. Now, where Japan has suffered is, of course, in terms of the economic recession brought on by the pandemic. Japan itself has coped rather well with the health pandemic, but given the fact that it is a aging, advanced economy in structural decline, grappling with productivity issues to begin with, we don't expect Japan to recover from pre-COVID levels of economic output until well into the decade, maybe as long as 2027. So that in itself will alter the distribution of economic power between China and the next largest player. I just wanted to highlight, though, that Japan remains an overachiever in our books. We determined that using a linear regression. It wields greater influence than what our model would expect, given its size and resources. And this year, we've done extensive network analysis to map the kind of relationships that exist between countries of our region. And what we see is that, for example, when you look at online search interest in the region, so who is everyone interested in, Japan clearly dominates above and beyond everyone else. So that's what you're seeing in front of you. Now, let's turn to India, because India is obviously the fourth most powerful country in our region, and one that many, including in Australia, hope will one day have the capacity to level in terms of its economic power with China. But similar setbacks to Japan for different reasons. India has lost the most in terms of its pre-COVID growth trajectory. We have had to make some adjustments to its long-term 2030 forecast. It will be 13% smaller than what we had forecast for the end of the decade last year. And in effect, that means that India will only really reach 40% of China's economic output on current trend by the end of the decade, as opposed to the 50% we had forecast last year. So it has delayed the rise of India. On the other hand, India has shown ambition, and it is very much rooted at the center of the political geography of defense diplomacy in our region. We see that, for example, here in terms of the number of defense dialogues that are held annually, that India is very central, has become very central. It's also overtaken Seoul and Moscow in terms of diplomatic influence. So there has been some good signs, particularly in terms of New Delhi's stepped up ambitions. Now, where I wanted to end was in terms of three middle powers. We can probably go back to the screen. The silver lining in the race to the bottom and in the fact that China, though its power is level, the power disparity with the rest of the region has increased. There are three middle powers that have actually, oddly, registered gains in their overall standing in the region, despite the havoc wreaked by the COVID-19 pandemic. And they are Vietnam, Australia, and Taiwan. Now, the performances of these three powers illustrate how the future is likely to be defined by some version of asymmetric multipolarity. Geraldine Doogue had to laugh at that, a very big word on Radio National a few days ago. But by that, we mean that neither in a situation where neither the United States nor China can establish undisputed primacy, the actions, the choices, and the interests of middle powers actually become more consequential, both to the regional balance of power, but potentially also to shoring up the regional order. I will leave it at that. There's much more to unpack, obviously, in our results. We can explore the website later on, but I'm very keen to hear from our panelists. So I will go straight to the senator, Senator Wong. If you could basically tell us how you interpret the balance of power in light of the pandemic, and particularly Australia's role in this, in what's eventuating.
Well, thank you, Hervé, and thank you to you and your colleagues at LOE for yet another extraordinarily detailed and weighty contribution to foreign policy discussion in the launch of this index. So, and thank you for the opportunity to participate. I also want to acknowledge the very distinguished professors, Professor Nye and UN, who I'm sharing their virtual screen with. I kind of wish you were put one of them. I figure they actually know a lot more than I. I'll make a couple of observations and I have. The first is that obviously the pandemic is changing the world in ways that we can observe, the ways we are experiencing, but in ways we do not yet understand fully. Secondly, we recognise that the world is experiencing the greatest economic downturn since the Great Depression, and that the power index, I think, demonstrates the consequences of that. We understand it also is intensifying great power competition, and that nationalism is rising and regrettably multilateralism is fraying, and we face a less stable and more divided and a riskier world. I wanted to make two points about that without spending a lot of time on what is actually happening. The first is I think it's useful to think about the pandemic as both an augmenter and an accelerant of the disruption that we're observing, both in our region and globally. And that is, it represents a new scale of consequences for the regional and global order change. And the sort of relative power shifts that you've described in the power index and in your introduction, I think demonstrate that. What does this mean and how do I look at the index? I think it's important to start with this proposition that in this sort of time of change, what is critical is that leaders, whether they are thought leaders, such as those I'm sharing the virtual space with, or political leaders, it is very important that we better understand the shifts, the dynamics and the trends of change, because understanding that is just so critical to managing risk, potentially to averting tragedy, and also obviously to enhancing opportunity. So from my perspective as a political person in this, this is in great part why the power index is so important, because the geopolitical consequences of the pandemic aren't theoretical or abstract, and nor are they slow moving. You know, they are here and now, and we are having to make decisions, think about policy frameworks, think about priorities and the allocation of resources in real time, and it's a very important tool. Some of my takeouts from the index, first, again, the imperative of enhancing the capacity, our capacity, certainly from Australia's perspective, to influence, to hedge and shape. I think that imperative has intensified given the context. Secondly, and you went to this in your introduction, I think the three main factual observations are the hit on US power that you described, the growing differential between China and the region, and, of course, the way in which India's position has substantially worsened given its GDP impact between now and last year. My next takeout was also in terms of the measures of power that you identify, which are both resource-based and influence-based, we need, certainly from a middle power perspective, we need to do better with what we have. So we have to maximise our influence-based measures of power more, even more than we are seeking to do now. And the final observation I'd make is the extent to which climate policy and climate, the approach on climate can yield soft power dividends in this world, not just for the, you know, the imperative for humanity, which is we're currently on track for an excess of 3 degree change, but from a strategic perspective in terms of our capacity to engage with the region. And certainly from Australia's perspective, I think our position and influence is substantially diminished, most obviously with the Pacific, but more broadly by the current approach the current government to climate policy. So they'd be my observations first up. I'm obviously very happy to participate in the discussion, and thank you again, Ervo, to you and your team for the great work and for enabling me to participate today.
And thank you for taking the time out of a very, very busy week in Canberra. We really do appreciate it. I might go to Professor Nye next to give us perhaps a more global and an American perspective on the findings and what your view is of the strategic balance between the United States and China.
Well, I agree with Senator Wong. I think the effects of COVID have been more or less to reinforce existing trends. There's a little bit less economic globalization. There's a worsening of US-China relations, which are already head in the wrong direction, and somewhat more authoritarian politics in a number of countries. And I also agree that the US has lost a great deal of soft power. The ineptitude of the way the Trump administration has handled the pandemic has weakened one of the things that made America attractive, which is a reputation for competence. So I think in that sense, I agree with what the senator said. But I think some of the problems we saw in your survey this year actually had pre-existing conditions, to use a phrase related to pandemics. The U.S. had already begun to lose a good deal of soft power under Trump. Partly it was Trump's America First attitude, which devalued multilateralism and alliances. I've just published a new book called Do Morals Matter? Presidents and Foreign Policy from FDR to Trump. And what you notice with Trump in 2016 was a departure from what had been American foreign policy for 70 years, which was a policy trying to create a liberal international order based on multilateralism and alliances. Trump turned his back on this, and you could already see in polls like Pew and Gallup and so forth, a decline in the attractiveness of the US. So I think you saw some of that already occurring. But I would argue in terms of, is this going to change the position of the US and China in, let's say, your index 3 or 4 years from now, as opposed to over the past year? I'm not so sure. If you look at the types of power resources, in the global perspective, the Americans' power resources are three times that of China and what we expend. And we have a global reach, and China has an Asian reach, which of course is the subject of your index, but still has to be put in a broader global context. In the economy, if you measure by exchange rates, which I think is a better measure of power than purchasing power parity that you use in the index, after all, you don't import jet engines or oil at purchasing power parity, you import it at exchange rates. The Chinese economy is about two-thirds that of the US. And while I think the better performance in the second half of 2020 economically of the Chinese might take a year or two off the period in the early 30s when Chinese economy is the size of the US economy, I don't think it's going to lead to a quick reversal. And on the soft power issue, the ability to get what you want through attraction rather than coercion or payment, most indices that have looked at this, like the Portland Soft Power 30 Index, rate China down around number 27. The US is usually up in the top half a dozen or so. And that's reinforced by various polls, by Pew and Gallup and so forth. So I don't see this reversing the position of the US and China. In other words, I don't see it. I think China has caught up in the short run, and you properly measure that in this year's survey, or index. But will this mean a big change, let's say, by the end of the decade? I'm less convinced of that. The Americans have a number of advantages, power advantages, which really go beyond COVID. Geographically, we have two oceans and two friendly neighbors. China has 14 neighboring states and has serious territorial disputes with some of the biggest, like India and Japan, Vietnam. The US in demography has an expanding population and labor force. China's labor force peaked in 2015. In energy, the US is pretty much energy independent. China still depends on imports of oil across the Indian Ocean, where its supply lines are vulnerable. And there are a number of other things, alliances that the US has, whereas your index shows China lags behind, and so forth. So I don't see this as, if I've tried to guess ahead to your index a few years from now, I don't think this is going to prove to be a critical turning point. I think that Senator is correct. It's more accentuation and acceleration of some existing trends rather than the point where people will look back and say, that was the turning point. Finally, to conclude, I should say that we sometimes think that big causes must have big effects, but it's worth remembering that in the great influenza epidemic of pandemic of 1918, a century ago, which killed more people than died in all of World War I, it was a horrendous thing, much worse than COVID. Yet most historians by the year 1930, looking at the geopolitical effects, would say the big geopolitical effects, like the rise of fascism, the rise of communism, and so forth, were the product of World War I, not of the pandemic. So yes, this COVID is a big thing. It's going to have big effects. And we've seen the effects in the short run of the past year or two in terms of what your index shows. But if we look ahead to 2030, similar to 1930, I suspect it's not going to turn out that the COVID was the big turning point.
Very interesting. And thanks for putting that in a longer term perspective. I'm going to go over to Professor Yun Kong for the view from Southeast Asia.
Thank you very much, Hervé. And I agree very much with what Senator Wong and Professor Nai has just said, that it's important not to overstate the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic, and that it basically accentuates trends that we have seen. And so let me say something about the New Asia Power Index 2020. Congratulations. I usually look forward to the publication each year to check on the state of balance of power in Asia. And for those who take the results seriously, there are policy ramifications. But I also want to say what a wonderful pedagogical tool the index also is. Every August, I ask my graduate students, most of whom are from Asia, to describe the balance of power in the region. The overwhelming majority before being exposed to the index, say that the region is multipolar. I then ask them to go to the LOWIS website for the 2019 index, and they'll be taken aback by your findings, which suggests that Asia is bipolar. Now, whether one agrees with those measures and scores, I think one has to contend with them. It is a classy and mind-changing operation that you have there. Congratulations again. Now, in terms of the impact and balance of power, I think the index captures the pandemic's impact on the perceptions of the balance better than words can. If we just focus on the two at the top of the heap, the US and China, China's comprehensive national power is unchanged according to the index compared to last year. While the US is down 3 points, that's well within the intuitive feel of those of us who watch such developments. So China's undeniable success in containing the virus and its ability to get the economy moving does show impressive resolve and governance abilities. But its delay in warning the world about the virus initially and its transactional approach to its mask diplomacy, not to mention, you know, the wolf warrior diplomacy, all this, I would suggest, count against China. And in a sense, they cancel out the achievements I mentioned earlier. And so intuitively, that helps explain your China's stagnant score. The US's 3-point decline, I wager, is the result of the perception that under this administration, the US has failed miserably in containing the virus, and economic recovery has been stalled, with analysts expecting, you know, an overall GDP contraction for the year. Now, insofar as the balance of power is about relative power, China's keeping its place and the US's 3-point decline suggests that China is closing in on the US. China was 89% of the US's power in last year's index. It is 93% today. For students of the rise and fall of great powers, it is when the rising power approaches 80% or more of the established power's strength that things start to get interesting. The rising power will start to act funny or assertive, especially in demanding changes in regional and international arrangements to reflect its growing clout. And that helps explain China's assertiveness for me in the last decade. But I think the question we need to ask is, what's the end game of this assertiveness? That takes me to the second point I want to share. Joe's colleagues, Graham Allison and Bob Blackwell, asked Lee Kuan Yew some years ago, if China intended to replace the US as the number one power in Asia and the world. And Lee's reply was, I quote him, yes, why not? They've lifted 600 million of their citizens out of poverty by an economic miracle. And it is their intention to be the greatest power on earth, unquote. Now, in the same breath, however, Lee also said that for this century, China just wants co-equality with the US. The question then is whether the US is able and willing to grant China that co-equality. My hunch is no, in part because China, as Joe said, is still behind the US militarily and economically. But more crucially, I think it's because it is not a democracy. So if the US is unwilling to grant China this co-equality, and indeed, if the US has concluded that despite 40 years of integration into the world capitalist economy, China has and will not transform into a liberal democracy, the stage, I'm afraid, seems set for an intense bipolar strategic rivalry, maybe reminiscent of the US-Soviet Cold War, except that this time, China is a much more formidable rival, brandishing an alternative model of development that seems to deliver the goods. And I think we can agree that both China and America's reputation have been sullied by the pandemic in different ways, to be sure. But for many in Asia, where performance legitimacy trumps political complexion, in measuring prestige, for example, China, despite being the source of the virus, may end up being the beneficiary with its successful containing of the pandemic and its resumption of economic growth. And countries in the region, perhaps excepting Australia, may see China as the so-called wave of the future, a term favored by Chinese diplomats, and they may hedge accordingly, despite historic ties with the US. And I'll end with this, the rising power does not need those who are unaligned to switch their alignments in its favor. All it needs is that they accommodate it or take into account its core interests as it creates facts on the ground that will compel the established power to recognize it as a co-equal in due course. I think I'll stop there.
Thank you very much for those very energetic remarks. I've got questions for all three of you, but let me actually go back to Senator Wong for a moment. You've just heard a view from Southeast Asia. One of the findings this year has been, and I may actually even be able to share my screen here, but one of the findings this year has been that Australia has really excelled in terms of its defense diplomacy. So we've seen the rise of quadrilateral, trilateral, bilateral, variable geometry arrangements with a number of players, prominently among them Japan and India, but also Vietnam and others. Do you think that this suggests that in some sense there is a consensus forming between middle powers in Southeast Asia and Australia, or are there still significant differences between ourselves in terms of how we approach the alliance with the United States and Southeast Asian powers who may take a more equidistant approach, a more hedging-like approach with US and China? So how does Australia go about that? How do you see our improvements in defense diplomacy this year?
Well, first, in terms of improvements, Australia has a long history of being effective multilateralist and effective plurilateralist. I could go through some of the things I think the current government could do far better. I think we are skimping on diplomacy. We are seeing, Alex Oliver and her team at Lowy have outlined in great detail. We've seen further cuts to the capacity of the Department of Foreign Affairs. As I've said, I think our position on climate change undermines our credibility, and we've had nearly $12 billion of cuts to development assistance, and all of these are active decisions by government that reduce our power and our influence at a time where I think we need to expand it. But can I come back to your central point, which is the region, and I think the way to think about, or the way I seek to think about how we go forward in this time is to think less about the binary of China-US competition and more about what sort of region we want. And in doing that, I think I'm mindful not only of the comments which are being made today, but of Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong's point about Southeast Asia doesn't want to choose and the consequences of doing that. I think from an Australian perspective, what that means is in terms of maximising the outcome we want is to recognise that, in effect, we've already chosen as a US ally, but that's not the end of the matter. And if we're seeking to maximise our influence and our engagement with the region, our objective has to be what can we work with and with whom on the sort of region we want? So I think about it as a Venn diagram, which is how is it that, what is it that we share? There will be many things we will have different interests with different nations, for example, within ASEAN, but there will also be a range of areas in relation to what rules and norms apply in the region, how we deal with issues of sovereignty and territorial, including maritime disputes. There will be a range of areas where there is a confluence of interests, a coalition of interests between us and a range of countries in the region. And to achieve, and we find a better term for what asymmetric multipolarity, I think, but to achieve the sort of balance in the region we want on the terms that we want, we have to shape that the way in which strategic competition in the region is played out. And I think we best do that by by finding areas where we do we share interests with middle powers and other powers in the region, and we work together to do that.
Interesting. I mean, one of the subjects of debate in Australia has also been about aid and development towards Southeast Asia in post-pandemic recovery efforts. We've seen, I think, 11 million people in the Pacific and our near abroad receive more aid than all of developing Asia combined. How do you see that? Should we be redressing that balance as well?
Oh, we have to take a much greater leadership role than we have to date. And we understand, we look at the position of the nations of Southeast Asia, look at the potential, the economic vulnerability, and the absence in many nations of a public health framework which enables effective management of the pandemic. And we have to really, I think, step up in Southeast Asia to work with the region on both the economic and public health response. We've done it before, John Howard in the aftermath of the tsunami. And I'd make this point. Obviously, it's Australia alone is not going to be able to change how the pandemic and the economic recovery plays out in Southeast Asia, but we can play a much greater role than we're playing, particularly in galvanising and working with the region in their response. I think back to the GFC when Labor was in government, and I was in the aftermath of it was the finance minister, and Australia took such an important role both through the G20, but also within the region, around coordinating and galvanising multilateral and plurilateral economic responses. We haven't done that, I think, sufficiently now, and I think we have a responsibility to do that and an opportunity to do that. And, the countries of Southeast Asia in various ways, and I think have made very clear, that they have very clear views about what their priorities are, and we ought to be better working with them. I think the way I describe it is we've got a Pacific step up here in Australia. Whilst I've had criticisms of it, that is an important thing. We should have a commensurate Southeast Asian step up.
Thank you, Senator. I might go back and actually try to play with both what Professor Kong mentioned and what Professor Nye seems to indicate, which is that the US maintains huge comparative advantages over China in many ways, and China's rise is beleaguered by quite a number of weaknesses. In our assessment, and we're working on a research project that looks at different scenarios beyond 2030, and what we can say about that, we haven't launched it yet, but yes, I agree with you, the single best measure, if you're going to choose a GDP measure for power, obviously we choose 128 indicators over any one indicator, but the single best economic measure of power is probably market exchange rates, because it factors in things like sophistication, the market power of currencies, as well as the productive capacity of countries. Now, all of those things are aggregated in different parts of the index, which is why we've gone with purchasing power parity as a single indicator within a basket of 128, just to represent the productive capacity. But even at market exchange rates, it seems as if we're heading to a point where the US and China, towards the end of this decade, may start leveling. We're not sure yet, depending on the scenario, whether the US maintains a narrow lead or whether China surpasses the US by a margin. But either way, it doesn't seem as if China ever really pulls ahead by a significant margin. And so my question to Professor Nye is, can you envisage a future where the United States remains the globally dominant power, but where China is a sort of level equal in Asia? And what would be the implications of that for US global standing? I mean, it's a very curious juxtaposition between regional hegemony and global hegemony. And then I might just go straight to Professor Kong. I think what happens in a future where China becomes, I think in your assessment, the more dominant player in Asia, what do Southeast Asian countries then do? And does that actually open up differences between them? There's a very interesting indicator that we have this year looking at UN voting alignments, and they suggest that Southeast Asian countries, I might just quickly share my screen if I can, Southeast Asian countries, really tend to vote together, and there's a sort of regional consensus almost, and you can almost you can identify, this is UN voting alignments at the UN General Assembly, you can identify distinct clusters. You have North Korea, China, and Russia in one corner. You've got New Zealand, South Korea, Japan in the other, and Australia a little bit further away, and the US very much sort of the unilateral Lone Ranger. And then you've got this grouping in the middle. And what does that grouping in the middle do? I mean, it suggests to me that they're slightly more non-aligned. Are we moving in a more Sino-centric direction? Are they going to be starting to trend more towards China, or do they continue to hedge, is my question to Professor Kong. But let me start with Professor Nye.
Well, I want to echo something that Senator Wong said. I think it's a mistake to look at Asia just in the perspective of bipolarity of the U.S. and China. I think the people who are overly structural determinists, like my friend and colleague Graham Allison, who talks about a Thucydides trap and that we're destined for war, I think they're wrong. I don't think they have a very good theory on this. I think what's more interesting is how will the agenda of global politics change over the course of the next decade? If you're going to see ecological globalization increasing, which is different from economic globalization, but climate change is an example of ecological globalization, and pandemics are an example of ecological globalization, and they respond to the laws of physics and biology, not to politics, you're going to see quite a different politics coming up in the future, and relationships, which is going to place a much greater role for many middle powers, such as Australia. In addition to that, what you're going to see is, instead of what a lot of people in Washington are talking about, a new Cold War, you're going to have what I've called a cooperative rivalry between the U.S. and China. And it goes back to the title of a book I wrote 20 years ago called The Paradox of American Power: Why the World's Only Superpower Cannot Go It Alone. And that means if you're going to do something about climate change, which is a major threat to us, China is the biggest emitter of greenhouse gases now. If you're going to do something about pandemics, and I'm afraid COVID is not the last pandemic we're going to see, you're going to have cooperation with China. So if we get into this bipolarity, Thucydides trap that's co-equal or dominance and so forth, you're going to miss the fact that the agenda of international politics may require us to think differently about power. In my book, Do Morals Matter, I distinguish between what I call power over others, which is traditional ways of competing, and power with others, which means you can't achieve your objectives without working with others, which goes to the importance of alliances, multilateral institutions, and soft power. In that kind of a world, if that's the world we're going to see in 2030, and I suspect we're going to see more of it, we're going to have to learn to think of power with at the same time that we think of power over. And that's where middle powers can play a very important role, which is keeping a sense of proportion and balance in this relationship. If we actually fall into a structural determinism of U.S.-China rivalry, we'll all be the worse off for it, no matter who's on top.
Professor Kong?
I think Joe's points are very, very well taken, and it's very hard to argue against one of the greatest students of power in the world. And but from the view of Southeast Asia, I mean, that's one reason why a lot of the policymakers and leaders here talk about not wanting to choose. And that's because they have been feeling the pressures from the two giants to choose, all right, on the AIIB, on the BRI, on Huawei 5G, on free and open Indo-Pacific. All these things on the menu have been put forward by the two giants, and they twist arms, they apply pressures. on the Southeast Asians as to how they should, you know, which side they are on. So the mantra from Southeast Asia is not something that is happening in the abstract. But that is why so many of the leaders just say that they do not want to choose. All right. But we got to be a bit careful in dissecting the meaning of what they mean when they say they do not want to choose. Actually, it means that they do not want to move, in my view, from where they are now. Now, where they are now is not smack in the middle. If you think about Cambodia and Laos, they are probably more aligned with China than they are with the US, right? And if you look at some of the Southeast Asian countries in the last decade, you can think of countries like Thailand, Malaysia, the Philippines, Brunei. They probably have inched away from the US and slightly in China's direction. Doesn't mean that they are in China's pocket, but that's the trend. That's the directional, that's the movement they seem to be going, the direction that they're going in. Whereas Vietnam and Singapore may still feel more strategic comfort with the US. But I think the point to make about these movements is that they are not cast in stone. They remain fluid. And I think over the next decade, and Joe is exactly right here, there will be choices. I mean, they are not, the structure doesn't determine how they will choose. And I think, in fact, the choice they will choose depending in part on their domestic politics, the actions of the two giants, their perception of economic opportunities, and their perceptions of American staying power. All right. But one thing I wanted to point out is that when you choose, you know, you got to choose from a menu. And we have to think about who is doing most of the cooking in the last decade. You know, who has been putting things on the menu for, let's say, the ASEAN countries or the Pacific, you know, countries. And if you look at, you know, initiatives like the AIIB, the BRI, RCEP, you know, 5G, China seems to be putting a lot of things on the platter. All right. The US had won TPP, all right, which was, in a sense, borrowed from Singapore, New Zealand, and Chile, right? Brunei initial attempts. And the first thing that the Trump administration did was to, you know, abort this scheme. So the next US initiative is the free and open Indo-Pacific. Now, that seems really interesting and helped by Japan, but ASEAN has a slightly different interpretation. So I think I'll overall, the point I'm trying to make, I guess, on this choice matter is that I think we need to watch to see how the ASEAN countries choose over the years. And my fear is that one may just choose piecemeal, you know, unlike in the Cold War where you choose wholesale to start with one or the other. A series of piecemeal choices over time may put you in one camp or the other without your really intending it to be that way.
Fascinating. Look, we're almost running out of time, but I wanted to ask three more questions that I see are also very popular in terms of the questions we're getting on our panel. But the first one being, obviously, Ewan has just outlined a region in which Southeast Asia may make a series of almost subconscious choices that lead in the direction of a more Sino-centric order. I find it rather remarkable that despite a clash of great powers in our region, despite a pandemic, one of the most successful initiatives to emerge out of our region, and you forget to mention, is the homegrown ASEAN initiative of the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, which is a huge multilateral exercise, brings together lots of Southeast Asian states that are variously aligned, from Cambodia on the one hand to Vietnam on the other, and more importantly, brings in developed economies like Australia and South Korea, sadly not India, but it seems to me that also offers a kind of multilateral hedge to the asymmetrical economic clout of China in our region. So I'm going to direct this observation or question to Senator Wong. How should Australia weigh the balance of priorities between multilateralism, the multilateral forums of our region? ASEAN is often dismissed as being anachronistic and no longer particularly helpful for dealing with, you know, geopolitics and security challenges, versus Australia's inclination to want to do more selective multilateralism or minilateralism. How do we weigh those priorities?
Well, I think that, just checking if I need it. I think that flexibility is important, particularly in the context of the pandemic and in the context of intensifying strategic competition in our region. I suppose this is perhaps a simplistic response, but I do take quite a practical view about this. We should do what we can resource, and we should prioritise those engagements and fora which yield practical benefits for Australia and our partners. And so I think, and if we take as the end point what I was discussing, which is what is the region we want, how do we best, as a substantial power in the region, work with others to shape that outcome, to hedge, to balance, to mitigate risk, to enhance opportunity, but essentially to shape this through this period, the sort of region we want with the sort of principles, norms and rules that we want. And you work back from that and say, well, what does that mean? Well, obviously it always means engaging with ASEAN as entity and with ASEAN nations, the nations of Southeast Asia, either bilaterally or within, you know, minilateral fora. It always means that. But I think it is sensible for us to also ensure that, you know, we respond to more flexible initiatives in the region. We have issues-based opt-in structures which are of benefit to us and our and like-minded nations. I'd make the point, I think it's very important in terms of how Australia approaches this, though, is to not approach those new groupings or new engagements entirely from a defensive mindset. And whilst I understand the sort of pragmatism that Professor Yuen is describing, where he says when people say they don't want to choose, they mean they want to stay where they are, I understand that. But I think the point is not to think about nor articulate in how we engage with the region new initiatives, opt-in structures or existing engagement with existing structures so much in a defensive frame that is defined by the binary of strategic competition between the US and China, but rather what do we all want? Wherever the equilibrium ends up in 5 or 10 years through this, what do we want that to look like? And I suspect there's actually a great deal of confluence of interest in that.
Finally, I want to turn to Professor Nai. You talk about the need for some cooperative rivalry or competition between US and China. You know, it's multidimensional, but that there can be some sort of settling point between the US and China. It strikes me that perhaps the outcome of this election will determine one way or the other whether we will see a continuation of a sort of more assertive China containment strategy versus something more nuanced from the Biden administration, which on the one hand competes with China and on the other hand engages with it on the issues it must. So how do you see the election playing out in terms of US foreign policy, but also coming back to your earlier to your book, Do Morals Matter, about the moral standing of US presidents? How do you see the choice that confronts your country in light of the two candidates that are very different?
Well, I at this stage, we don't know whether Trump will be reelected. The polls suggest no. But if he is reelected, I suspect what you'll see is a continuation of the type of policies we have now, and the relations with China will become considerably worse or strained. If Biden is elected, you're still going to have difficulties in the US-China relationship. There are many people in both parties who feel that China did not play fair, that it tilted the playing ground in its favor, that it's been aggressively nationalistic. So that's not going to go away, but you're going to get a very different tone. Biden has said, for example, that he would rejoin the Paris Climate Accords. He would make sure we did not leave the World Health Organization. He would strengthen American alliances in the region and in Europe. So you'd have quite a different tone in terms of how the relationship would be played. And in that context, I think you'll see greater capacity to put some of these new issues into the relationship. There are some areas where we and China have different security issues, and we shouldn't kowtow to them, if you allow me to use that word. Huawei building 5G networks in our countries is a major security threat. We should never allow that. And that's not just a question of twisting arms. It's a question, do you want people in Beijing, obeying the Communist Party, to determine what happens to the Internet of Things, which is going to run over a 5G network? So I can be quite tough on that, at the same time that I want to say I want to work with China on lowering carbon intensity of their growth and our growth. And I want to work with China on strengthening the World Health Organization and getting better cooperation among scientists to deal with pandemics than we had and saw in January of this year. So what we've got to do is learn to do both at the same time. I think Biden is capable of that. I don't think Trump is capable of it.
And do you think that it's possible to do business with a regime in Beijing, which has become increasingly nationalistic, you know, the rise of war for diplomacy? Do you think that it's possible? And then I also want to take you to a question that's often been posed here, which is around Taiwan. What should the US do to seek to bolster the position of Taiwan, which is very vulnerable? Taiwan is included in our index as a territory claimed by China. It's not a recognized state. Nevertheless, its international reputation has been enhanced slightly, particularly this year with the successful handling of the pandemic. What should the US be doing in relation to Taiwan that would improve the security of the island?
Well, on the first point of how China is turning to nationalism to replace high rates of economic growth as a way to legitimize the monopoly position of the Communist Party, I think that's a danger for China. It's very hard to increase your soft power or your through face mask diplomacy if you're simultaneously practicing wolf warrior diplomacy. The two don't fit together very well. Just ask the Indians how they feel about the Himalayan border after Chinese killed Indian soldiers on the border. I think that's an internal contradiction that China has to face up to. But if you say, can we deal with them on climate change in the Paris framework at the same time that they're misserving their own self-interest by too much nationalism, well, that's the problem. We can do both. We can condemn one and try to encourage the other simultaneously. As for Taiwan, the American position has been for decades now, no use of force and no unilateral declaration of independence. And within that framework, that box, so to speak, the relationship between the two sides of the strait should be worked out or bargained between the two parties, the mainland and Taiwan. There is some talk in the US now that the US has to make it a little clearer that this that we do have an interest in making sure about that no use of force to strengthen our ability to deter the use of force. But the general framework of our policy, I think, will stay the same, which is no unilateral declaration of independence and no use of force to solve the problem. And I think some slight toughening of our deterrent posture there may be coming, but I don't think they're going to see a major change in the policy framework overall.
Right, and one more quick fire question for both Professor Kong and Senator Wong. We heard the announcement yesterday that Australia had been invited or re-invited to the Malabar exercises. The quadrilateral grouping seems to be on the ascendance or in the ascendance. What do you make of it, Professor Kong? And then we'll end by Professor Wong's judgment on the prospects for the Quad. Yay or nay?
I think China will feel besieged. This is a development of the coalition of the democracies sort of countering China's rise. And China has been saying that the West has been containing it for the last 10 years. So this will fit into the discourse in China, which says that the democracies are ganging up against it. So this is the kind of multilateral cooperation that China would not like to see. But, you know, and that will fit into the competition in Asia that, you know, China is engaging in. And with China eventually, you know, hope to come on top of.
Senator Wong, can the Quad hold its weight?
Oh, well, I think like-minded nations can talk to one another and work with each other. The Quad has bipartisan support here in Australia. It doesn't diminish our commitment to the centrality of ASEAN, nor does it diminish our commitment to working with other nations about the sort of region we want. We shouldn't discuss it or talk about it entirely from a defensive perspective. I think it is about throwing forward where do we want to be and working with others with whom we share interests. So we are supportive of it.
Positive overall. Right. Well, that ends the hour. It's been fascinating. I'm sorry we haven't had more time to be able to go into all these levels of detail and debate, but it's been absolutely fascinating. I've thoroughly enjoyed the hour, and I thank you very much for being here today as we launch this 2020 edition of Asia Power Index. Thank you all for joining, and we'll see you next time at the next Lowy Institute Live event.
Thank you.
Thank you.